possible if the U.S. makes a realistic decision. Is the U.S. ready to make a realistic decision? And what does a realistic decision even mean? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we'll try to find out what that means. We will take a look at why the U.S. continues a maximum pressure policy and things like sanctions to have incurred on Iran, including ship confiscations, and yet it does not want to deem the deal to be dead. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter joins us from Bethlehem, New York. Also joining us, political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshesh, who joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'm going to first start with you, Mostafa Khoshesh, because I'd like to understand what Iran's foreign minister meant when he said, quote, "Now we have reached a point during the negotiations that if the American side makes a realistic decision, an agreement would be within reach." I'm curious as to what you think he means by that realistic decision referral.
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, this has been the case for the past 2-3 months. Before the Russians raised concerns about the future of the deal, some problems started because the Americans started buyer's remorse on a couple of issues. The number one issue was the red sanctions list. I'll explain about it later if necessary. And then the removal of the IRGC from the foreign terrorist organizations list. And also, a third issue pertains to one specific category of guarantees. Iran has requested guarantees, four types of guarantees: nuclear guarantees, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees. And now there has remained some one or two of these issues. People are well acquainted with the kind of guarantee Iran has requested from the Congress. Iran has said that either the Congress should endorse any future deal, or the Speaker of the Senate or the Speaker of the House should issue some kind of statement in support of a deal. And all of it is because the U.S. has violated the deal. It has proved to be irresponsible. If a deal comes up, common sense rules for receiving as many guarantees as possible from the United States, that's one of the main necessary issues that Europeans have requested European companies, as well as Asian companies. One of the high-level diplomats in Tehran was telling me some 2-3 months ago that if Iran expects us to return for investment in Iran, we do not agree with whatever guarantee the U.S. gives unless one specific type of guarantee, and that's economic guarantee to you and to us, that states that the U.S. would respect our contract. Investment contracts are long, like 10, 20 years. So for the entire duration and lifetime of that contract, no matter what happens to the JCPOA and if the U.S. stays under the JCPOA or not, once it is revived. Okay. So this has been requested by foreign companies, and before dealing with the IRGC issue, these sanctions and guarantees issues are highly important to economic interests that Iran should receive from any kind of revival of the JCPOA. And one more sentence. But Amir Abdullah Young said the U.S. should take a realistic look means that instead of going for, a media hype and, hues and cries about IRGC's removal from the FBO list, they know that before we come to that point, specific point, they need to resolve issues with regard to the sanctions and guarantees. They are hiding that. They have tried to derail public attention to the IRGC issue. That means they are just playing. They are not working for real solution of the problem in order to have a deal.
Do you agree with that, the fact that the U.S. is doing that, Scott Ritter, that there are... Well, let me use the words of the Foreign Minister, Abdullah Hian, before I get an answer from you. Quote, the U.S. blacklisting of IRGC is only a secondary issue, nation's top priority. In fact, IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups, a secondary issue has been magnified by the pro-Israeli lobby, and our main priority is the interest of the Iranian nation. That's what the Foreign Minister has said in Davos. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, that the issue of the sanctioning of the IRGC is a purely political move by the United States. It has no practical impact on Iran's nuclear program, on the JCPOA as a whole. It was done under pressure from members of Congress who are themselves under pressure from the the pro-Israeli lobby here in the United States and the Israeli government itself. But I'll take a step back. I remember reading about the deliberations of the Iranian parliament in the lead up to the finalizing the JCPOA in July of 2015. And there's some very, very difficult discussions. The Iranians knew up front that the United States was not a trustworthy partner because it's there in black and white. They said so. And the Iranians were looking for assurances at that time that the U.S. could be trusted to stay the course. And it turns out that the Iranians were right, that the U.S. is not a trustworthy partner. And it's not just Trump that betrayed the agreement. In April of 2015, prior to the JCPOA being finalized, Barack Obama, the hero of the JCPOA, gave an interview to National Public Radio where he said, issues like the sunset clauses are not carved in stone, meaning that once the agreement's made, the United States will come back and reconsider whether or not it wants to allow these sunset clauses to expire, or if we're going to create a whole host of issues to control Iran. The United States has no intention of allowing Iran to possess a nuclear enrichment capability that the JCPOA says it's allowed to. And Joe Biden was the vice president of Obama. He has inherited that policy. And Joe Biden today, I will just state right up front, has no intention of allowing the JCPOA to reach maturity, that whatever agreement is reached now is a short-term agreement to buy time to force or compel the Iranians to backtrack some of their commitments or some of their advances that they've made in the nuclear arena while the United States works with Europe and others to find a new tactic to constrain Iran. A renewed JCPOA isn't the end of the crisis. It's just the beginning of a new crisis.
What makes you think that, though?
Because that's what the Biden administration's policy is. Listen to them. They're straight up front. They are not going to let the sunset clauses expire. They're just not.
Okay.
They will impose. One of the reasons why they don't want to have ironclad prohibition against the resumption of sanctions is that once they bring the Iranian nuclear program under the control of the JCPOA, they want to retain the ability to impose new sanctions if necessary to put pressure on Iran to make compromises and the rights that it has successfully negotiated for itself under the JCPOA. So ask any Iranian negotiator. They'll tell you that's the case.
Well, Seymour Sabah-Hosheshma, obviously the Iranian side is very much well-versed in tactics that the U.S. has used. And at least I'm not there at the negotiating table, but I'm guessing that it's a very seasoned, well-informed team that has the experience of the previous team that was there. And what Scott Ritter says there, I'm sure they are also speculating that or using that in their calculations. So how do you go about going into the revival if you have that many doubts involved?
Well, that's exactly the point why Iranians are asking for guarantees that they would receive the merits under the deal. That's why they do not agree to go beyond the JCPOA. They have already stressed in response to the Biden administration's repeated demands for going to JCPOA over Iran's missile power, over Iran's regional power, and God knows the list continues, and God knows when and where they want to put an end to this long list of Iran's power components that they want to harness, that they want to contain. You know, they don't have any kind of problem with Iran's nuclear power. They got a problem with Iran's power as a regional power. That's what they want. They are not for a conflict resolution in there. Iran and the U.S. have, or its allies, they have signed 6 agreements over Afghanistan, Iraq, 3 atomic accords with the Europeans, the Troika of Europe, from 2001 to 2005, altogether 5 agreements. And the 6th one was the JCPOA. In all of them, Americans admit that Iran has been completely loyal to its undertakings. Why? Because Iran wanted a conflict resolution and believed that the other side is there for a conflict resolution. But the Americans had only one major undertaking, removing the sanctions, and they never did that because they are not there for conflict resolution. They are there for their containment strategy that includes using carrot and stick policy in order to slow down Iran's progress in various areas of power, in the nuclear industry, in the missile power, regional power, drone power, and so on and so forth, then stop Iran's growth, and then start a rollback in order to push back Iran's growth. Now, Iranians know it pretty well, but they want to show their good intentions, but they are no fools. They have the lessons received under the administration of President Rouhani. They know Americans are not responsible party, and they should receive guarantees. That's exactly one of the major points under discussion, under debate. But Americans do not want to discuss it. They want to just do some kind of media, show, and claim that the two sides are in trouble over only one single issue, while this has never been the case since February.
Well, we're still looking at officials from Iran who are making a case for this, Scott Ritter, and also the Americans who don't want this to be dead because they're saying that it's still the best viable option. Whether you're talking about the U.S. Secretary of State or you're talking about the special envoy, Robert Malley. Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Abdollahian, and another quote from him that I want to get your reaction from, is that Iran must avail themselves of the full economic advantages of the JCPOA. The talks have been going on for quite some time. Is Iran looking to see a cycle be completed in the midst of the time that has elapsed from the beginning until now? And perhaps there's a test that's going on so that it could then draw a conclusion as to now is the right time to finalize the talks? Are we looking at a certain scenario of that kind?
Look, I think if Iran could get the guarantees from the United States, although I would caveat it, and I'm sure the Iranians believe the same, because they don't trust America, nor do they have a reason to trust America. But America will not comply with any agreement they make with Iran. That's absolutely certain. Even if Iran gets all they want, statements from, read the Constitution. A statement from the Speaker of the House is meaningless. A statement from the Senate Majority Leader is meaningless. The Constitution is the only thing that matters, and the only way to make an Iranian agreement with the United States on the JCPOA, one that the United States must adhere to, is for the Senate of the United States to ratify a treaty, a formal treaty. Anything less than that makes this an executive decision made by a president that, while it may have the force of law while the president's in power, if he's replaced by another president who disagrees, like Donald Trump, it will renege it. And this is what's going to happen, because the United States is not going to give up the capability to snap back inspections in the future. the United States is trading off the promise of immediate economic gain for Iran, short-term economic gain, so that Iran will sign, will agree to the terms that the U.S. has put out there. The U.S. will come back to the JCPOA, and everything will be fine until we get to the issues of the expiration of the sunset clauses. Then the United States will start to raise new issues, and when Iran refuses to depart, the U.S. is going to impose sanctions all over again. That's a reality.
Okay, well, let's take a look at another issue that we need to talk about, because it's always there.
May I add something in reference to this battery there?
Yeah.
Scott, that's why Iranians actually worked out a long list of guarantees. You know, from these four types of guarantees, three of them, I mean, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees, they all depend on the U.S. goodwill in compliance with, you know, its endorsement. And we do know that the United States, as you said, would not act in compliance and in goodwill. That's why the first type of guarantees that they call essential guarantees or nuclear guarantees, you know, they were the first that Iran worked and ensured to have, because it depends on Tehran, not on the U.S. compliance. But it's the only type of guarantee that Iran can rely on because it stays under Iran's power. What is it? When you keep your highly advanced centrifuge machines in store, sealed under the IAEA, but inside Iranian territory, under Iranian control, without dismantling. Number two, if you keep your materials, nuclear materials, intact in Iran, store them here. Number three, if you keep your know-how, nuclear know-how that you have earned intact and without any pause in continuing these studies, then you can ensure that if the U.S. starts defying the nuclear deal, if it is revived ever, then you don't lose anything. You will not sustain damage or losses.
Can we get Scott Ritter to react to that?
That's a deterrent factor. That's a deterrent factor against, one more sentence, that's a deterrent factor against the United States defiance, because that means if you just go astray, if you defy the accord and your undertakings, we start doing the same thing, the 60% enrichment, and maybe we will start 90% enrichment.
There you go. Okay, Scott Ritter, so he's got a valid point there. What would the U.S. do? Would it risk that?
Again, I don't trust anything. If I were the Iranians, I wouldn't trust any agreement that the United States. Look, Iran's not stupid. They've been betrayed before, and I understand the intent of these nuclear guarantees. You know, but Joe Biden is dealing with domestic American politics as much as he's dealing with you know, international security or you know, geopolitical issues. And Biden is going to, if he's going to re-enter the JCPOA, it's only going to be because he gets some sort of political boost here at home. No matter what the United States agrees to, Iran needs to understand that the policy of the United States mirrors the policy of Israel, and that Iran cannot be allowed to have a functioning, modern, capable nuclear enrichment capability, and that they are going to do whatever they can to ensure that in the long term, Iran doesn't get this. Now, they may make some compromises up front for political reasons to rejoin the JCPOA. Israel right now is saying that, at least some people are quoted in the Jerusalem Post, saying that a bad JCPOA is better than no JCPOA right now because it does retard Iran's progress in the nuclear enrichment field. So I think there's a lot of political impetus to get a short-term political bounce from finalizing the JCPOA, but in the long term, the United States and Israel, and maybe many of the European partners of the U.S., will be looking for ways to undermine Iran's nuclear enrichment capability going forward.
Well, since you mentioned Israel, I got to get this out of the way. Quick answer, if you can, on this, said Mostafa Hoshesh. Many analysts and headlines, I'm sure, that you're familiar with have said, was the assassination in Iran another Israeli effort to sabotage the JCPOA? Because previous killings, according to one entry, actually took place at times when Washington and Tehran actually appear to be on the cusp of a diplomatic breakthrough, perhaps. Do you agree with that? Is that what may have happened?
First of all, Scott, we are on the same page. That's right. Just for the record, we do not trust America. We do know that the United States has never been loyal to its undertakings. They would not stay loyal to this deal. Some might ask why then we are in the talks, because we have paid our dues in cash upfront under President Rouhani. We've never received anything. 2 years, 3 years maximum is left from the JCPOA's 10-year-long period. And we are there to see if we could earn cash in, I mean, what we've been promised. If possible, good. If not, then we don't, you know, rely on that as our main foreign policy pivot. But in response to your question, I'm not from those guys who believe that the Israelis are acting so separately against their strategic partner and want to sabotage or torpedo the deal. On the contrary, I believe that when they assassinated Iranian IRGC colonel Martir Khodai, and just 48 hours later, it's the prime minister of the Zionist regime, again, the same regime that has done the assassination, that declares officially that the U.S. will not withdraw the IRGC from the FTO list. That has a lot of meaning. That in a matter of 24 hours, there is a Senate hearing there. Menendez, the senator, and Rob Malley, the U.S. envoy on Iran, they confirmed the decision. They approved, and I mean, they endorse what Naftali Bennett has said. That means this kind of decision by the United States has been a green light to the Israelis to do the assassination. Exactly. That is to say, the Biden administration has okayed the Israeli assassination efforts. They've given a green light to go ahead with this policy in order to pressure Tehran, to remind Tehran that we have more options to harm you. Definitely, there will be a response to that. There will be retaliation. There will be escalation. The end, we believe, would not be beneficial to the Israelis and Americans.
Okay.
But American policy is also to be blamed. They are also responsible for this assassination, despite the fact that they leaked it to New York Times and tried through that article to send this message to Iran that we are clean of this assassination that has been done by the Israelis. It's not been our decision. We didn't want it. Israelis have informed us we are not responsible. But Iran would not take that. We believe Americans are also guilty. They have blood of Colonel Khodai on their hands as well.
All right, very well. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. And let me thank, that was Mustafa Khoshesh, their political analyst. Thank you. And former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, thank you. Spoke to us from Bethlehem, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, behaving with the enemies. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about how to behave with the enemies and our behaviouring with the enemies. When we look at the Islamic context, it says us that even if two people have dispute with each other, or maybe there are two different people who are enemies of each other, Islam stops us to be first in having this kind of thinking that we are enemies. The actual thing that Islam says is that you need to get rid of the concept of being enemy of each other or harming each other. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic teachings, it is said that it is not good to have dispute all the time. Why? Because, you know, when we are having a dispute, We are basically spending our time in that, and we are wasting our time. Therefore, it is necessary, according to the teachings of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that even if you have a dispute, or if you have a dispute, or there is an enemy of you, show the nobility of yourself to him. Be noble with him. And this, if you are a person who is noble, you can obviously can show generosity to him. And this will change the minds of your enemies. Even if they have done bad to you, on the first step, show generosity, be noble, and be kind with them. So when you show this, this will change their mind. And if they're not changing, then obviously there are the other steps that you can take. But the first thing that the Islamic teachings teaches us is that we need to be to have the generosity, we need to have mercy, we need to have kindness with the people who with whom we have disputes. Maybe they do not accept our things that we say. But the first thing is that we should not be amongst those who takes the first step in having this dispute. Therefore, we need to deal with the people with the generosity, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of behaving with the enemies. And we said that Islamic teachings teaches us that when we need to deal with the enemies, the first thing is do not take the first step in having this dispute, and have your generosity and kindness with the enemies, even those who have dispute with you. The second thing which Islamic teachings teaches us is that if you have a dispute with someone, or if you know that there is an enemy of you, but you never know that he will bring a harm to you or not, do not get engaged with such an enemy. And if you believe and if you know that he will never harm you, then obviously there is no need of having any engagement with such an enemy. Or if in general life, if we have someone with whom we have dispute, so it is better to not to talk about them, not to, you know, highlight the things that they say. Why? Because it saves us from many things, many, many things, and many problems that we can have in our life. It will save us from those things. And that is the thing which Islam teaches us. And obviously, when you know your enemies, Islam also tells us that be careful that tomorrow, if they come in the face of a friend, when they dress up as a friend, and when they come to you, remember that they were your enemies. For example, when in the Quran, Allah talks about the story of the Prophet Adam and Eve, there Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells them that the shaitan is your enemy. And we know that shaitan came in the dress of friend. He dressed up as a friend, and he came as a friend in front of them. And he gave them this advice of eating that specific plant, which was prohibited by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, we need to be very much careful when we deal with the enemies, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbass people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted, and they hit schools.
They just do not consider us to be human. They're only civilians here, children, women, and old people. We're separatists for them. We're non-human for them. Let it be in no man's land. That's their attitude.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance.
If it's proven that NATO weapons were used, what would you say to NATO countries?
They act in a wrong way. Let them come here and see what they give to Ukraine, which is used against us. Let them come and see. I wish in this moment they were here, so they could feel it themselves.
In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in operation distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war and many other things too. But the party is currently in operation frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. but it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they've mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition like malaria rather than COVID that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There is also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Purizep, London.
Meeting in Brussels, EU leaders have agreed to place an embargo on 75% of Russian oil imports, increasing to 90% by the end of the year. 4 weeks ago, Moscow cut off gas supplies to EU countries Poland and Bulgaria. Now Russian gas to energy firms in Netherlands, Denmark and Germany is being switched off. EU leaders say they won't back down and will continue to send arms to Ukraine.
Since the beginning of the war, leaders and the member states stepped up and announced by now 200 billion euros in extra military spending.
It is clear that most citizens don't support the move.
We are still just speaking about sanctions, giving arms and stuff. We need to speak about peace and diplomacy.
I'm against spending more and more money for weapons. Because that is only going to end up in more conflict, because the only purpose of weapons is to use them against somebody else.
Amid criticism from US war hawks, German and French leaders have been defending their decision to keep lines of communication open with the Kremlin.
I do endorse discussing with Vladimir Putin on a regular basis, with very demanding approach and full transparency with President Zelensky.
Many analysts suggest the West created this crisis by not listening to Russia's security concerns, and apparent efforts to reach out to Moscow recently are merely a charade. EU leaders have now returned to their capitals, but senior officials here at the European Commission have told Press TV that work is well underway on a seventh round of sanctions targeting Russia. Peace activists continue to ask the question, why does all the emphasis seem to be on escalation rather than diplomacy? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since the presidential vote, France's unions marched nationwide, as the nation's public services will likely be under major attack for the next 5 years. Polls show President Emmanuel Macron will likely have almost as strong a grip over Parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the Eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or many French could be too scared to protest given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in Operation Distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war, and many other things too. But the party is currently in Operation Frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. But it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they've mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition like malaria rather than COVID that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There's also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Purizep, London.
A British government minister has launched a direct attack on the pro-Palestine boycott campaign against Israel, claiming that the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement fuels anti-Semitism, including hate crimes in Jewish-rich areas of London. Speaking while visiting Orthodox Jewish community leaders in North London, Community Secretary Michael Gove was quoted by a pro-Israel newspaper stating,
"The BDS campaign is not about running an ethical foreign policy. The BDS campaign is designed for only one purpose, to attack and delegitimize the state of Israel and the idea that there should be a Jewish state at all. The campaign has not only undermined efforts for peace in the Middle East, it also leads to community tension in the UK. We have seen an increase in anti-Semitic incidents, and the BDS campaign is a driver of that."
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. Pro-Israel groups have long lobbied British authorities to act against the practice. Those demands appear to have been answered. With plans announced to ban economic and cultural boycotts of Israel with new anti-BDS legislation announced during the Queen's speech on May the 10th, a move slammed by pro-Palestine activists.
First and foremost, I think Israel is really concerned with its accesses against the Palestinians, and the civil society is rising up against that. This concern obviously means that the supporters of Israel want to make sure that Israel can continue with its occupation, and they want to close down all potential avenues that highlights the Israeli aggression and human rights violation. And therefore, we see the British government, the Conservative government, who's very close to Israel, to stop the British citizens from trying to carry out their democratic right.
Since the Queen's speech, several government ministers have targeted the BDS. Just last week, Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the BDS racist during a talk at a pro-Israel event. According to Mr. Gove, the anti-BDS legislation will be put forward to the House of Commons before the end of this year. The move, described as a chilling attack on democracy, will also potentially face legal challenges, meaning that the fight for Palestine here in the UK is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. The prominent Iranian cleric presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Maybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Arafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Arafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Arafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses' rents, treatment, and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil, or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid. Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
1 million Americans, over 90,000 people in California, and over 30,000 Los Angeles County residents have died of COVID-19. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Erin Powell and Nicola Alenkin researchers. This article is published under the heading, How Many More Seniors Will Die of COVID-19 in Los Angeles County? Here's the story. One million Americans, over 90,000 people in California, and over 30,000 Los Angeles County residents have died of COVID-19. The most vulnerable groups are seniors and people with disabilities, especially those that are homebound. The LA County Board of Supervisors should have made homebound people a priority. Instead, it failed them throughout the pandemic and continues to fail them today. The story begins with a phone call made in 2020. As the pandemic was getting more deadly, a tenant living at Bernard Way in Santa Monica died of COVID-19. Bernard Way is a 61-unit Section 8 complex with older, disabled, and poor residents. Sean Casey O'Brien, who lives in the building, contacted the office of the LA County Board of Supervisors to request testing for building residents. A young staffer spoke with Sean and Ari Powell, one of the authors of the article. After two meetings, the staffer indicated that the county itself could not provide the testing. The staffer suggested that the residents go to a local testing location just a few miles away. For many residents who had limited mobility or simply did not want to risk exposure to COVID-19, this was not remotely helpful advice. Homebound people stay at home, typically for medical reasons. They need extra help with shopping and basic daily needs. A homebound person needs the help of another person or medical equipment, such as crutches, a walker, or a wheelchair to get them around. The Board of Supervisors estimates that as many as 275,000 people in the U.S. are homebound. As reported in Becker's Hospital Review in August 2021, the percentage of homebound adults increased nationally from 5% in 2011 to 13% in 2020. Latino adults were most likely to be homebound in 2020 at 34% compared to African American adults at 22.6% and white adults at 10.1%. In March 2021, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors unanimously passed a resolution which created a vaccination program that served the often forgotten homebound. The resolution asked the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health to present a plan within 21 days. The plan was approved unanimously. The COMIT team, along with allies at Social Security Works California, were optimistic that the county would follow its own plan to vaccinate homebound residents quickly and efficiently. After all, Los Angeles County is the biggest county in the nation with nearly 2 million residents over the age of 60. The county has a budget of $1.3 billion with the capacity to bring in more if needed. Unfortunately, their optimism was short-lived. For a while, it was difficult to even receive data on how many homeland vaccinations took place. In 1 2-month period, four different counts were reported. For a while, the county said they could not keep count because they had outsourced vaccinations to other groups. Finally, on January 25, 2022, the leader of the Department of Health reported to the county that their program had only administered 4,718 vaccinations to homebound residents. This fell massively short of the county's March 2021 mandate to vaccinate 275,000 homebound residents. COMIT Social Security Works California and the public expected far more from elected leaders. So they regrouped and moved into full advocacy mode. Their mission was and remains to push the county to do what it promised to do. today have four simple asks for the County of Los Angeles, and they are: issue a report to the public every 2 weeks with the number of vaccinations given through the homebound program. Promote the program through television appearances, op-eds, or announcements in Los Angeles Times and other